Hope you're enjoying your lunch. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with Thomson Reuters and the Board of Governors here at the FCC. Very pleased you could join us today. Before we get started, a couple of quick housekeeping notes. First of all, please remember to switch your mobile phones back on when you leave the club. We're filming today's event, so we like to switch them off here. Second of all, a couple of notes about upcoming speakers at the club in the next few weeks. After today, the next lunch will be John Terence Hung, Reflections of a High Flyer from Stanley Prison, talking about his business experiences and time in Stanley Prison here in Hong Kong. Should be interesting. And also, later this month, we'll have the Shadow Treasurer of Australia, Joe Hockey, speaking here. I believe that's on the 25th of October. Now, to the event of today. I'm wondering if many of you share a similar experience to me every morning when I wake up in what is relatively glossy Hong Kong. Over a first cup of coffee, I open up the papers and my iPad and start to read through the latest on the Eurozone debt crisis. I hear what Trichet has said, what the French have said, and every day, inevitably, all I can say at the end of reading these articles is, what a mess and where is it going from here? Well, I'm very pleased that Hugo Dixon, instead of giving us his usual pithy paragraphs on the latest on Eurozone, will give us a longer speech of about 20 minutes and have time for question and answers on the Eurozone debt crisis and what it means for us here in Asia. Hugo?
Thank you very much, Tara, for introducing me in such wonderful terms, and it's fantastic to be here at the Foreign Correspondents Club. I always get a high when I come to Hong Kong because people are so much, or China as well, or in fact Asia is, because there's so much more optimism here compared to the gloom of the West. And it is gloomy in the West, and I'm afraid if you're looking for an optimistic speech, you're not going to get one. I think the problems are clear enough, reasonably clear anyway. I mean, it's the old story of too much debt and too much consumption. And I think it's important to realize that some people think we have two crises. We had, the first, the credit crunch, and now we have the Eurozone crisis. But in fact, these are just two phases of one crisis, an excess debt crisis and a deleveraging, an excess debt boom and a deleveraging crisis. But they have been punctuated by two shocks. And the first shock was the death of Lehman Brothers in 2008, which did create a near heart attack to the financial system and then had a huge psychological impact, which then ricocheted through the real economy, leading to the recession. The second shock is not as severe as that first shock yet, and that second shock, you could say, probably took place in July, August, with all of the wrangles over the Eurozone, simultaneously the wrangles in America over lifting their debt ceiling. And it's a little early to say what the psychological impact of those events is, but it's clearly not positive. And I think that it will be, it may be enough to tip us in the West anyway into a double dip recession. But what is clear is that there are no easy solutions to this problem. And this is a difference between this phase of the crisis in 2011 and the earlier phase of the crisis in 2008. In 2008, the governments could ride to the rescue. They had fiscal bullets that they could fire. They were able to engage in Keynesian science-style stimulus, and they were also able to do some things on monetary policy. Well, there is very little room for any more fiscal stimulus. As we know, the fiscal stimulus of 2008-2009 has, to some extent, contributed to the sovereign debt crisis of 2011. Even here, in this part of the world, there's a limited ability. I mean, I think that there's, you know, China clearly is in a better financial position than the West, but it doesn't have limitless firepower to keep pouring money into more infrastructure, more roads to nowhere, or whatever, when the returns on those old investments are virtually zero. When you look at monetary policy, I mean, of course, when interest rates are virtually zero, you can indeed do quantitative easing. But even quantitative easing, the stimulus benefits of that are fairly minimal. It shouldn't be surprising that we're having a hard time, though. And it shouldn't be surprising that there aren't any easy solutions. I mean, it's sort of karma. We are sort of, you know, paying for the sins of the past, and there's not a way that you can wriggle out of that. It's just a question of how you manage through it. And it's not just a matter of financing problems, although financing difficulties are severe. It's also a question of structural difficulties. And people talk, of course, the euphemism that people talk about is rebalancing. Well, rebalancing is not a nice, easy process where you just sort of move things a little bit from here to there. It's a real wrenching of the gears and a changing of the structure of how economies work. And it means that whole swathes of industries that have been operating in one way and people who've been working in one job, they may find that those jobs no longer exist and they have to reorientate and retrain. And sometimes they can't do that because they are too old or lack the skills, or it's just too difficult to assemble the necessary critical mass to make things happen. So that rebalancing or changing of the gears is a wrenching process that's happening pretty well everywhere. So you've got that structural issue combined with the financing difficulties. And there's limited things that can be done. But the limited things that can be done are still really important to be done. Top of the list is you've just got to avoid a financial meltdown. So it's critical that the banks, we don't have a sort of 1930s style banking collapses, because that is desperate. Well, that's one thing. Second thing is also like the 1930s, critical that we don't resort to protectionism. And of course, there are, you know, little signs of perhaps that emerging with the whole sort of spat between America and China over the exchange rate. We've got to hope that people keep their heads and realize that our economies are so intertwined that it really isn't going to do anybody any benefit. Even the politicians will not benefit from that. That's at least what we've got to hope. The third thing is that in these difficult times, it is still important to build for the future. It is still important to try to reform your economies so that they are actually fitter for when the upswing happens. And then the final thing is leadership. And of course, leadership is always in short supply when you need it most. And leadership is not about trying to pretend that the near-term future is going to be good, because it isn't. But it's about giving a credible long-term vision that will allow people to manage their way through the difficult short-term situation while seeing that there is something there that is worth fighting for, that will come, and therefore the hard work will ultimately pay off. I'd like to now turn just to the epicenter of the of the current phase of the crisis, which is indeed what you've asked me to talk about, which is the Eurozone. Clearly, as Tara said, I mean, it's not just here. I mean, it's everywhere. People wake up thinking, what a mess. And the zigzagging policymaking, one policymaking saying one thing and Merkel saying another thing and Trichet another thing and Sarkozy, etc. And I mean, is extraordinarily bad for confidence. And there is a view, which is, why the heck can't they just bail everybody out and everything would be dealt with? Europe is rich enough, when you look at it collectively, it could deal with the problem. Unfortunately, it's not that easy, either politically or economically. The Eurozone isn't a country, and it's not ready to be a country. And those who, I mean, the sort of one extreme version of can't they just bail everybody out is the idea that what you really need is you've got the monetary union of the European of the Eurozone, you need to complement that with a fiscal union and perhaps even a sort of a Eurozone government. The people are just not ready for it. And it's if you try to force something which is so much against the grain, it will blow up in an even more spectacular fashion. And so then, of course, there are others who say, well, that just shows that monetary union was a disastrous thing to have in the first place. And even, and these are the Eurosceptics, and even that we should therefore dismantle the single currency. Well, unfortunately, that position isn't a very attractive one either, because yes, some of the countries that entered the euro shouldn't have been allowed at all, and the whole project was clearly premature. But it's very hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube, and nobody has come up. I mean, the best paper I've read on dismantling the euro, or certainly kicking Greece out of the euro, is by Nouriel Roubini. But even that didn't really answer the question of how you could possibly create new currencies or even one new currency in a multi-member treaty-bound situation, which is the Eurozone, without there being a run on first the Greek banks and then pretty much all of the banks throughout the periphery of Europe as savers realized that their savings were going to be probably lose half their value when this new currency came into effect. And that would be so damaging that we really, although the euro would have been better if the euro hadn't been created, we're stuck with it. So we're stuck with, we're not ready, remotely ready for fiscal union, and we're not able to pull out of the monetary union. And economically, you also can't do that, let's just bail them out and just pour the money in. That isn't going to work either, because Europe doesn't just have this financing problem, it also has a structural problem. The structural problem in many of the countries of competitiveness. And if you just pour money at it, you will not solve those underlying problems. And so what is needed is a whole host of supply-side reforms. And actually, behind all of the terrible headlines, there is some good news. And the good news is that Europe is getting fitter. Labour markets are being reformed. Pension ages are being pushed up. Corruption is being tackled. Tax evasion is being tackled. Civil service is being slimmed down. All of these things will, in time, make Europe fitter. They are not giving any benefit in the short run, but we must not forget the importance of having a long-run solution. So what is left If you can't go down the route of fiscal union and you can't go round down the route of dismantling the monetary union, well, you're left with the current muddle through strategy. And finally, I mean, I'm an optimist, sort of. Finally, there are signs that they're muddling through. I mean, it's not pretty, it's taken far too long, it's causing too much damage, but the Eurozone is finally coming towards something which would be a sort of coherent way forward, and it has three elements, all of which are long overdue. The first element is allow Greece to default, but do it in a controlled fashion and keep inside the Eurozone. The second element is stuff the banks full of capital, and that's not just the Greek banks, but the banks right across Europe. We've had so far three so-called stress tests of the banks, which have, surprise, surprise, showed that the banks need almost no money. The last one in July said that they needed 2.8 billion euros collectively, and gave a totally clean bill of health to Dexia, the Franco-Belgian bank that had to be rescued last week. A bit like last year's stress test that said the Irish banks were all fine and then they needed to be rescued. Well, finally, details are not there yet, but finally it looks like they're moving towards a significant recapitalization, maybe of the order of 200 billion euros, not 2 billion. That is certainly the sort of number that's required. And then the third element is what to do to contain the other countries, and the big one is Italy. And people used to talk about Spain, but the big one is Italy, and Italy is the big problem. If the euro collapses, it will be because of the dysfunctionality of the Italian government, and primarily the single biggest culprit will be Silvio Berlusconi. But Italy is said to be too big to bail, and also too big to fail. But it is, and that's probably true. Not necessarily. I mean, there are ways that you could provide a little bit of containment for Italy, and there are also some scenarios where you could even allow Italy to collapse without, I mean, it would be disastrous, but without necessarily the whole Eurozone collapse. But those are pretty difficult scenarios to deal with. So what you're left with is the central scenario, which is Italy has to save itself. And Italy economically can save itself. One of my favorite facts of that I discovered last month is that the net wealth of the Italian people is 8.2 or 8.3 trillion euros. The net wealth of the German households, and there are 20 million more of them, is something like 6.2 trillion euros. So on a per capita basis, the Italian people are richer, significantly richer than the German people. They have no business being asking for the Germans to bail them out. Why are the Italians so rich? Partly because they save so much, and partly, of course, because they don't pay taxes. And the solution is, it's quite simple. The solution is for them to pay taxes, and then the problem would be dealt with. The problem is, it's a political problem. How do you, when you've got such an awful prime minister in place, how do you actually bring things to a head? And I mean, anyway, if I'm putting my optimist hat on, it looks like the Italian political situation is being brought to a head. Berlusconi is the sort of the cat with nine lives, but he's used about 99 of them, but maybe he only gets 100. And there are signs, I mean, like earlier this week, he lost a key vote on his budget by one vote, and his finance minister didn't even turn up for the vote. He was delayed by a funeral. And the head of his leading coalition party was in the parliamentary chamber. Wasn't in the chamber. He was in parliament, apparently outside, chatting to journalists. So maybe he's on his last leg. Anyway, My prediction, because I'm an optimist, I'll give you my prediction, is that the Eurozone will pull through, but there will be more scares in the process, and it's not going to be a pretty one. And when I say it's going to pull through, I'm not saying we're going to have a period of good growth. We're not, because again, it's karma. We have to pay for our sins. Thank you very much.
Let's see if that works. There we go. So questions from the audience. Please raise your hands. We have microphones going around. Raise your hand. Tell us who you are and where you're from. I guess we'll start back on the veranda there. Let Hugo take it.
Shall I say this is man in the other room? I'm afraid I can't see every table, but...
I'm Tohan Shi from the South China Morning Post. Do you think the situation in Europe will go so bad that Europe will openly express its desperate need for money from China? And if so, do you think China will lend so much money to Europe that the renminbi will be so widely circulated in Europe that the renminbi will become a de facto international currency like the United States dollar?
Obviously there have been individual European countries that have been trying to curry favor with China. Obviously it started with Greece and then you had Portugal, and even there was even a suggestion in Italy. I think there will be more of that. The latest idea is the idea of using Chinese and other BRIC money to provide a sort of side pocket to the IMF so that the IMF could then provide extra funds to make to solve the Eurozone crisis. I think that ultimately, if Europe is faced, there is a way of Europe solving its problems, which is for the ECB, the European Central Bank, just to print money, which is totally against the Maastricht Treaty, which is what set up the single currency, and it's also totally against the convictions of the Germans, who are the most powerful country in Europe. But if you had to have a choice between taking a lot of Chinese money with strings attached or printing a lot of European money, those would both be very unpalatable options, but I think ultimately probably Europe would choose the latter rather than the former. I think some Chinese money invested, money coming into bonds, maybe some direct investment, a little bit of money coming, if it does come through the IMF and it's sort of seen as IMF money, not Chinese money, I think all of that is perfectly possible. But a heavy amount of Chinese money with big strings attached, I think that they prefer to debase their own currency.
Jane Singer with Inside Fashion. you mentioned about the fact that they will work, you know, they'll find a way to not bail out, but to recapitalize or prop up the banks. Where will the money come from?
Yes. I think it is a bailout, actually. It will be a bailout of these banks. A few of these banks will get money from the markets. They'll find a private solution. Most of them will get money from their own governments. Most of the governments have got money to give their banks capital. We've done an analysis at Breaking Views, which shows that even Italy and Spain could afford to recapitalize their banks. But then you're left with the Greeks and the Irish. The Irish have sort of really done the job. You're left with the Greeks, the Portuguese, who are both in programs, but they'd need more money from their fellow Eurozone partners. There is this bailout fund called the EFSF, so some of the money would come from that. Also, Little Cyprus would need help because it made the mistake of taking a lot of money from Russians, laundering it, and then there wasn't anywhere to invest it in Cyprus, so they invested it in Greek government bonds, and so they got into a mess. It will be a bailout, and what is actually quite interesting is, or what will be interesting to see, is what are the conditions that are attached to this money that gets pumped into the banks. And the debate that is just beginning is what should happen to bonuses and what should happen to dividends. Should banks, if they're receiving large sums of capital injected from the taxpayer, or should they be allowed to pay out dividends to their shareholders? Should they be able to pay bonuses to their bankers? And as I said, the debate has just started, but my guess is that it's pretty clear which way the politicians and the public will think on that one. And that's one of the reasons that the banks are now sort of trying to wriggle out of this. They don't want to take government money because they know what's going to come with, there'll be a lot of strings attached to that government money. But I think that the lobbying power of the banks is fairly weak at the moment, and they'll probably get stuffed with the capital. And even if bonuses and dividends are not scrapped, I think they will be severely curtailed.
One other question, if I may, and that is simply that the last time there was a bailout, there was criteria put for these different countries that they had to reduce their debt by a certain amount. And I was at a presentation a couple of weeks ago with the economist from Commerzbank who showed us graphs about the fact that nobody has actually met any of those targets, and some of them have gotten worse. So now they're going to get another round of bailout. What's going to motivate any of these peripheral countries to reduce their debt?
Well, Ireland actually does seem to be making some progress. So I think you've got one, you've got of the three that are in bailouts at the moment, that's Greece, Portugal, and Ireland. Ireland is probably, somewhere between possibly and probably on a good track. Portugal is, it's early days because they've only been in a bailout regime for about 5 or 6 months. They have a new government. The new government does seem to be pretty serious, but it's discovering funny things. Like, it's wonderful little stories one discovers in the Eurozone crisis. And some of them are to do with little islands. There's the Cyprus story, but there's also the story of Madeira, which is a little island that's part of Portugal. It's had the same governor for, I think, 30 years. And they have been running up debts which were hidden, or certainly were not consolidated. And suddenly they just sort of popped up. And so now they're having to deal with that problem. I don't know if Portugal, as I say, they've got a new government that does seem to be serious. Greece is the real, is the real terrible case. And I think you've asked a very good question. They will default. They will have their debts probably cut by half. As part of that, they will still be required to stick with a reform program. But the question is, what leverage will everybody have on the Greeks to make sure that they stick to the program? And nobody's come up with a satisfactory answer. The best answer that I've seen is that you demand some collateral from the Greeks. And so you say, yes, we're cutting your debts, but we're also taking some collateral. The government actually has a huge amount of property. A lot of the land in Greece is held by the government. It's something that dates back to the Ottoman Empire. And you can't do much with this property, but you could theoretically put it in some sort of fund and have it sitting there for 30 years and gradually sell off little bits of islands here, there, and use the money to repay the creditors if the if the government doesn't do its job. But I agree, it's a very difficult question.
Quick one from me, Hugo. I'm still digesting this idea that per capita, Italians are richer than Germans. And given that you say Italy is the real interesting point to watch now, is there a chance that we'll see a big sea change in politics? Will these rich Italians, who must be pretty frustrated at this point, rise up in any way, or will we see a big political change there in the near future?
Well, it's quite interesting. There was a former chief executive of one of the biggest banks, UniCredit, who came up with an idea, or popularized an idea a few weeks ago, that there should be a one-off property tax in Italy, that they should raise, in one fell swoop, 400 billion euros. And that would be enough to take their debt level from 120% of GDP down to about 90%. It would only be 5%. It would be a one-off levy of 5% of the net wealth of Italian households. I mean, you couldn't do 5% on everybody. You'd probably have to do, you know, more for the rich and less for the poor. And amazingly, that idea has not been shot down. The head of the business group in Italy came out and, broadly speaking, supported it. I mean, not maybe not in all of its details, but basically said that maybe we need to do something like that. So there's that's sort of one sign. You've had the rich Italian people are not exactly rising up and taking to the streets as in, you know, Tahrir Square. Although there's been a bit of that. There was a bit of that in Milan earlier this year, and that was before the real crisis sort of took effect, where the Italian, but that's actually Berlusconi's hometown, and it's always been in sort of center-right, or for a long time it's been controlled by the center-right. Anyway, the center-left managed to take it in the mayoral campaign, even though Berlusconi, or maybe partly because Berlusconi put himself at the top of the candidate list. There is a feeling by the Italian, I think the rich Italian people are sitting there and they're getting worried because their wealth is contracting day by day. And it's no longer a question of, oh, well, Berlusconi, you might like him or you might hate him, but he's fun and he's harmless and okay, he has these sexual peccadilloes, blah, blah, blah. It's now a question that he's actually hit it. I mean, of course, it's not just Berlusconi, because he is as much a symptom of the Italian disease as a cause. I mean, they, after all, the Italian people have elected him three times. I mean, they are not innocents in this situation. So, but I think that there is a sense of change. But I must say I'm going to be down there in 10 days' time, so I'm not 100% sure where the tectonic plates are shifting, but they are shifting. The question is how bad does it have to get before he's removed, and has it, by the stage that he's removed, got so bad that it's too difficult to recover? This is you need to take things to the brink, both in Italy and more generally in Europe. You need to take things to the brink before you're going to summon up adequate political will to solve the problems. The problem is, if you take things to the brink, there is always a chance that you'll accidentally fall over the edge.
I've enjoyed your talk this afternoon. I'm John Antweiler from Wells Fargo Bank. I wonder if you could give us your view of what a Greek default will look like, because you have said it will happen, I think. So what will it look like?
Okay, I think it will be, well, it's not been, I don't think people have decided yet. So this is speculative. I think it's important to distinguish between controlled default and uncontrolled default. And a controlled default is a good thing. Uncontrolled default would be a terrible thing. I think that a controlled default involves cutting the forcibly. Although it's controlled, it doesn't mean that the banks and other investors are going to be happy. They won't. What it means is that you will come up with a haircut for outstanding Greek government debt. The total amount of Greek debt, the total value of Greek government debt in one way or another needs to fall by about a half. Since the existing government debt is, it's owned, you can sort of roughly say it's owned by three groups. One group is the private sector. I think that's about two thirds. Another group is the IMF. And then there's a third group is the Eurozone, whether it's the governments or the European Central Bank. Now, I think the general view is that the IMF will not get a haircut. The question is whether the European governments and European Central Bank, whether they get a haircut. Obviously, the bigger the haircut, if you exclude all of that official money from a haircut, and you just say it's the private sector that gets a haircut, then if only two-thirds of the total debt is getting haircut and you need to reduce the debt by a half, then the private sector needs a two-thirds haircut for the maths to work out. I think that the European Central Bank and the European governments will also get some sort of haircut, but probably not as big a haircut as the private sector. And so look at it all, say 60%, say let's, for rough, you know, rough numbers, let's say the private sector, in order for the maths to work, needs a 60% haircut. Then what has to happen is, because Greece is still running a deficit, it will need money for three things. It'll need money to recapitalize its banks, say 30 billion, something like that. It'll need money to pay, maybe that's high end, but it's roughly around that amount of money. It'll need some money to pay for its ongoing deficit until it gets into a surplus, its primary deficit, and it will need money to pay the interest on even the reduced amount of debt. So all of that's going to come together at, I don't know, the numbers are not really clear. I was looking at some numbers yesterday, but they hadn't been sort of properly finalized, but I would say 60. They'll probably need 60 billion. I mean, that's a complete, you know, it's a real finger in the air. I mean, you're pushing me what it looks like. So something like that. So they'll need that, and that'll have to come, again, from its European partners and the IMF. But that's less than the amount of money that was previously being promised. So before, you know, when people were thinking we'd do it without a default. So that's sort of roughly what I think that a shape of a Greek bailout. And then in return for having their debt cut, and in return for still getting some money, they will then be required to continue with the reform program. But as I said in the answer to the previous question, how do you get them to continue with the reform program? And there's a particular problem, which is that under this sort of proposal that I've outlined, a lot of the money that goes into Greece would be front-loaded, because you'd have to recapitalize the banks up front. You might even have to recapitalize the central bank. And normally when you want to motivate a donkey, what you do is you tie a carrot at the end of a stick, and so it follows the carrot. If you put the carrot in the donkey's throat and it munches away at it, it's harder to get it to keep moving.
We have time for one more question.
I'm Bob Meyer, PharmaLink. Michael Milken said, debt is just equity waiting to happen. And in the corporate area, that's what he did. They raised high yield bonds, but that was step one. With the step two of taking it out with equity, You've already mentioned recapitalization of banks, you know, Greece selling off the Parthenon and things like that. I was wondering whether there are any creative solutions being looked at in the Eurozone to try to turn debt into equity.
Not really. There's been a lot of talk in the banks about making sure that we don't have to get to another situation where taxpayers have to bail out banks, and avoiding that by turning debt into equity, bailing in the bondholders. The problem is that it's a very good theory to bail in the bondholders, but nobody ever has the guts to do it in the middle of a crisis, because they think if you bail in the bondholders in one bank, then all of the bondholders in other banks are going to go scared, and they're not going to finance the other banks, and then you'll have made the financial crisis even worse. So, I mean, we don't actually know exactly what will happen with Dexia, which is the most recent example, but the governments of Belgium and France have guaranteed future issuance of bonds. They haven't technically guaranteed all the old bonds, so there's theoretically a possibility that some of that debt could be turned into equity. But the assumption is that, yet again, the bondholders have been bailed out. And I mean, we've argued that there are ways that you could actually do this, you could engineer this, so that you could bail in the bondholders and avoid a financial crisis, but I must say it would require a lot of political decisiveness to implement the plan that we've advocated, and that is, of course, in short supply. So my prediction is they will be bailed out, not bailed in. Great shame. Taxpayers will foot the bill. Well, actually, it's not taxpayers, because taxpayers aren't paying taxes anyway. So it's all... very suboptimal.
We will leave it on that note. It's 2 o'clock. Hugo Dixon, editor of Breaking Views, thanks very much for coming. It is rare that we get deep insight inside Europe from this far away in Asia. So thank you very much for joining us. And a small token gift from...
fun.
Have a great afternoon, everyone.